Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Whiskey Rebellion. Frank and I are actually in the same room this time. We're actually in Frank's conservatory. We are not, in fact, drinking whiskey at the moment because it's not yet noon. Some of us have rules about those kinds of things. But and Frank, you're drinking. What are you drinking?
You've got. Well, a nice I'm drinking
of,
tea.
You got a nice cup of tea. Even though it's in Boston, which is known for drinking, dumping their tea in the harbor, you're drinking tea.
And I'm drinking from a Monticello mug. So there we go.
Go. I like a good American. I'm drinking coffee, but you know, so be it.
He hasn't been an expat long enough.
No. I don't think there's many things I will change about my life. I will drink, you know, whiskey instead of bourbon, but I think I'm going to stick with my coffee. So we, again, this week we had a sort of a hell of a time trying to come up with which topics to do and which ones we had to sort of put aside. First one actually has to do with the Super Bowl. So you are a Patriots fan, Frank. Congratulations.
Thank you, David. That's very kind of you.
But I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about the president's interview beforehand. Did you get a chance to hear his comments in the interview he did with Fox News before the Super Bowl?
Yeah, as many of you will know, President Trump did an interview with Bill O'Reilly, pre-recorded an interview with Bill O'Reilly that aired before the Super Bowl. I was actually en route back to Edinburgh when the Super Bowl began, and I'll say a little bit more about that later. But one thing that struck me, the quote that was widely replayed from that interview, was when O'Reilly put pressure on Mr. Trump to denounce Vladimir Putin. And Bill O'Reilly said repeatedly, "Yeah, but he's a killer. How can you defend him?" And Trump said, I'm paraphrasing, but he more or less said, "Well, we've killed people. You know, we're not so innocent." And I was struck by that. A number of commentators noted this. But what really struck me about it was the extent to which, and I don't think he's doing this consciously, but he is doing it, Donald Trump repudiates American exceptionalism. And American exceptionalism is, as many of our listeners will know, is a kind of set of ideas that most American politicians subscribe to. In fact, President Trump was constantly asked, "Don't you believe in American exceptionalism?" And he kept saying he did. And it's a set of ideas that basically assumes that America, the United States, is somehow different. It is exceptional. Now, we as expats will have our own views on this, but almost every American politician has to subscribe to American exceptionalism. This notion, at least as far as American politicians are concerned, that America is exceptionally good and a kind of city on a hill, as the image goes.
And we should sort of explain that metaphor, because that's the one that lots of people evoke. It actually starts, I believe, with John Winthrop from 1630, from a sermon where he describes the new, I guess, Massachusetts Bay Colony. As being a city on the hill, they'd be an example to the rest of the world. And that's a line that's been quoted, you know, repeatedly, especially in the 20th century. Kennedy uses that line. You know, Reagan uses that line. I think actually John McCain mentioned the city on the hill and said President, you know, he thought he was quoting Reagan, or said he was referring to Reagan, but obviously this is a term that has antecedents. You know, Sarah Palin used the line when she was running for vice president. So it's a term that comes up repeatedly with this, you know, very deep antecedent going back to the colonial period, that, you know, the rules that apply to other countries are in some ways don't apply in the United States. I think it's sort of some of the subtext of it, that not only is the United States going to be better and be an example for everybody else, but it's the rules that bind other countries don't necessarily apply to the United States.
That's right. And politicians on both the left and right have used this. As I said, during President Obama's two terms, he was frequently kind of pushed to declare that America was exceptional, as though this was a way to catch him out because he wasn't really a good American. What I was struck by was the ease with which Donald Trump seemed to be, as in so many other ways, simply ignoring the norms of American politics. Now, the history of American exceptionalism is more complicated than our American politicians would have us believe. So the phrase, there's some debate about the origins of the phrase. Alexis de Tocqueville, in his wonderful book in the 1830s, described America as exceptional, but he didn't use the phrase American exceptionalism. The actual kind of coining of that particular phrase is usually ascribed to Joseph Stalin, of all people, in the late 1920s. And there was a debate among communist revolutionaries, both inside and outside of the United States, as to whether America was exceptional. And this goes to the way American exceptionalism is often used, I think, is people on the right tend to see, and people within the United States tend to see, and admirers of the United States tend to see the United States as exceptionally good. And as you've suggested, David, as immune to the laws of history and economic development or whatever, it's an outlier. Critics of the United States, and often critics of the United States on the left and critics outside of the country, often see it as exceptionally bad. And this kind of inversion of the assumptions of the more positive version of American exceptionalism. What I find interesting, and this may be one area where I agree with Mr. Trump, is he simply says, no, we're like other countries. Yeah. And I think Trumpism and the rise of Trump and the election of Trump can in part be explained by looking at what's going on across at least the West in a kind of transnational perspective. And we can see this as expats ourselves. Whether it was the Brexit vote here in the UK or the rise of Le Pen in France, and there'll be a very interesting election in France later in the year, sort of white nationalist parties across Europe gaining ascendancy in certain countries. And I think Trump and Trumpism could be placed in this perspective, and the very phenomena itself undermines notions of American exceptionalism. And I think Trump himself, in making that statement of Bill O'Reilly, made a statement that's very, very interesting. I might even say profound, but not profound in ways that he understands. and a lot of the commentary was critical of him for saying this. How could you possibly say this? And it came from both the right and the left. So you can't possibly say this. So there was an exceptionalist response to it. But
it was one that sort of, if we say the United States isn't exceptional, and therefore we can learn from other countries and benefit from being part of the global community, that's sort of the sort of liberal rejection of American exceptionalism. Trump, I think, is doing something very different there, saying, oh, they've done bad things, we've done bad things, you know, and so we shouldn't, you know, hold anybody else to a higher standard. I mean, as a concept, I think it's very deeply embedded in the American psyche, this notion of American exceptionalism. I mean, I think Americans proclaim themselves as being the best country in the world far more than I think anybody else does. You know, and I think, you know, one of the experiences I've had living, you know, here and sort of thinking about talking to colleagues who are from other parts of Europe, you know, the supposition is, oh, I'm from a very good country, but we're flawed and we can learn things from other places, and we are part of bigger communities, and understanding bigger communities is important. I think one of the ways in which the ethos of American exceptionalism has been influential is, you know, thinking about the ways in which history is taught in the United States. Americans going to school K through 12 get a lot of American history, and they don't get a whole lot of anything else.
No, that's right. And, well, I mean, Americans, and from across the political spectrum, will, and you'll hear this all the time, will routinely refer to their country as the greatest country in the world. And on one hand, that's inherent in nationalism. People from other nations say that as well, and there is French exceptionalism.
Oh, to be sure.
But they, you're right, it's part of the national discourse in a way that's certainly extraordinary based on my own experience having lived outside of the country for 25 years. Yeah. You don't hear this to the same extent in other countries. Mm. I'll give you another example. It is unthinkable. Mm. No British politician would end a speech by saying, God bless the United Kingdom, or God bless Scotland.
Yeah.
They just wouldn't do it. Now, in part, that's testimony to the perhaps different levels of religiosity in the United States as opposed to Britain, but it just wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that I'm always struck by the way American U.S. politicians appeal to the founding fathers and seek their imprimatur. So everybody wants to get right with Jefferson or Hamilton or whatever when they're running for president. You know, Theresa May, when in her next general election, is not going to try to invoke William Pitt, the elder or the younger. And see, this isn't... But we think it's really
important. Or Alfred the Great. Right. The, like, founding father of, you know...
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, we're a country with very little historic memory, it seems. On the other, we're obsessed with our past, but from a very particular perspective. And it's all rooted in this exceptionalist...
And the ways in which our... You know, I think the oceans have something to do with this. But I think Europeans generally understand that their history is deeply embedded with the history of other nations, their neighbors, you know, the globe, in a way that I think Americans don't, as a quantum of, at least a part of this notion of American exceptionalism.
This has just occurred to me, so you may not you may dismiss it out of hand, and this is proof that none of this is scripted, dear listeners.
If they had any illusions about that.
What do you think of this proposition, David? American exceptionalism and notions that America is the greatest country on earth, as expressed by Americans, rather than being an expression of arrogance, which is how many people outside of the United States hear such statements, it's actually a statement of insecurity. You're truly great. You don't have to tell everybody you're great, right? Yeah. In fact, this is one of the, to bring it back to the current president.
Yeah.
His, you know, he keeps telling us how intelligent he is. Mm. Intelligent people don't tell you how intelligent they are. They don't need to. So is American exceptionalism or protestations of American greatness, are they a sign of insecurity? Let's put the country on the couch.
Yes. my husband has psychoanalyzed 300 million people simultaneously, but I think there's some truth to that, depending on which manifestation of American exceptionalism you're talking about. Obviously, I think, but how you fit that in with Trump and Trump's ego is, I think, sometimes challenging.
Yeah, well, let's separate them.
I'm not sure you can fit anything with Trump's ego, but there's not enough room, but... you know, one of the things about American exceptionalism that you see in some versions of it, but not in others, is this, you know, the city on the hill idea initially, you know, going back to the colonial era and the way that sort of Kennedy, I think, was using it, was about we have something to offer the rest of the world as an exception, and therefore we are deeply interested in the rest of the world, you know. The Puritans in Massachusetts Bay ultimately wanted not separation in Massachusetts Bay, I don't think. They wanted to reform England in such a way that England would look at them and say, they're doing it right.
They were going to save Christianity.
Exactly. We're going to be an example to the rest of the world, not an exception from the rest of the world. And I think, you know, Kennedy's, when he's thinking about American foreign policy and the ways in which America could serve as an example of democracy and free institutions and the rule of law and all these kinds of things, I think he was thinking about it in that model. Other people, though, when they use American exceptional, I think, are saying America is different and therefore, you know, we should cut ourselves off from the rest of the world because the rest of the world is not really relevant to us. And I think if Trump has a conception of American exceptionalism, it's in that, you know, make America great again version. It's an isolationist kind of approach in some senses.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I guess what this reveals is that there are lots of different manifestations of American exceptionalism. As I said, though, that interview really piqued my interest because at some level it was a repudiation of American exceptionalism. Well, and personally, and certainly having lived abroad and taught and thought about America now for a quarter of a century from outside of the United States. I mean, my own view is American exceptionalism is nonsense. The United States is an important country. It's a historically significant country with a unique history because all nation states have unique histories. And it needs to be studied on its own terms. But I think American exceptionalism is a nonsense.
Yeah, no, I think most historians would agree with you that we are in the, you know, the push towards sort of transnational approaches and all comparative models and global history or, you know, call... You know, the same thing, different names, whatever you want to. But I think that sort of modality, I think, is where the profession is going. And then people who really sort of are able to study the United States in isolation from the rest of the world and say, I don't really care what's going on in the rest of the world. I'm studying America. I think that's, you know, a modality that's probably disappearing in the near future.
Yeah, if it hasn't already. Yeah. Yeah. At least in academic, no, among academic historians, sure.
Yeah. So, Barnes & Noble is probably a different situation.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, indeed. Another thing that happened, to move on to our next topic, one of the really notable incidents this week was the confirmation vote and debate in the Senate over Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. And as part of that, there was a notable moment that caught a lot of attention when Elizabeth Warren attempted to read a letter from Coretta Scott King, the widow of Martin Luther King, about Mr. Sessions. And she
was, 30-year-old.
Yeah, a 30-year-old letter. Thank you. Yeah. And she was silenced. She was told she couldn't do this on the floor of the Senate. Kind of handing this over to you, David, because, you know, this was reminiscent of the implementation of the gag rule when it came to debates about slavery, I think, in the antebellum period. Do you want to say
anything about that? Well, I think the gag rule is a good example of, and I think that there's lots of sort of historical echoes that are going on. The gag rule, I think, is a good one. So the origin behind the gag rule from the 1830s and early 1840s was that the abolitionist movement was starting to send petitions into Congress, especially after 1830, and a lot of these were actually being introduced into the House by the former president, John Quincy Adams, who was then representing Massachusetts. And he would present these petitions and from abolitionists, mostly from New England, to the House. And in response to this, Southern congressman passed a rule basically tabling all these petitions before they could be introduced, which effectively silenced abolitionist and former President Quincy Adams from introducing new petitions. And it was seen, you know, as a way of sort of a manifestation. It backfired in some senses because it was seen as sort of a manifestation of the slave power, you know, silencing critics and limiting their constitutional rights to petition the government for redress of grievances. And it lasted until, I believe, 1842, when it eventually is repealed in the House, in large part because John Quincy Adams was able to sort of marshal a coalition to end it. But I think it's significant as kind of a moment of you know, political censorship in the House. I mean, I think the Elizabeth Warren situation sort of brings to mind sort of this whole question about how collegial Congress tends to be and the extent to which politicians at certain points in American history, even if they politically disagree, are able to socially interact in a way that is, you know, positive on some level, reach some level of political compromise. And there are eras in American political history where that doesn't happen. I mean, we can think back to the 1950s and 60s where obviously, there were huge amounts of political conflict and divisions within the country, on especially on questions about race and foreign policy and other things, but in which senators would play golf together, have dinner together, maintain a kind of level of civility, even if they disagreed with each other politically.
Annual softball games and things like that.
Yeah. And so, it's, you know, I think this is an interesting moment, because I think this is the Elizabeth Warren, you know, silencing kind of heralds, I think, what is, if we weren't already aware of it, that, you know, politics is clearly not in that phase where the opposition parties don't really have a meeting of the minds in terms of, you know, where civility, you know, allows them to have a community, even if they don't agree on the politics. And the Senate has always been known, I think, having those kinds of bipartisan friendships that seem to have sort of gone to the wayside. I can't think of any sort of prominent, you know, bipartisan friendships that are in the Senate right now.
Yeah, one of the most interesting ones in recent years was, of course, the friendship between John McCain and Hillary Clinton when she was a senator.
Sure.
And that seems to have been a really sincere friendship. And you're right. I mean, what's interesting about decorum and civility is that was one of the justifications used to silence Elizabeth Warren. So, you know, one of the Republican senators said, you know, you can't read this letter critical of Jeff Sessions because his wife is here. And wouldn't it be, it would be awful if his wife had to hear unpleasant things about him. Which was a really extraordinary justification. I don't think it was very persuasive, but...
the origin for the particular Rule 19 that was invoked to silence Elizabeth Warren actually, you know, dates back to the early part of the 20th century, and it was originally crafted in response to a fight actually between two Democratic senators from South Carolina, one of whom was Pitchfork Ben Tillman, a man who was known to brag about killing political opponents to gain his way into office. And he had a dispute with actually the other senator from South Carolina, a member actually of the same party, but they were worried that the dispute would go from being personal attacks on the floor of the Senate to being physical attacks on the floor of the Senate. And that was, you know, the origin of this particular rule. And I don't think, you know, Elizabeth Warren and Jeff Sessions were going to go at it on the floor of the Senate. It's an amusing thought to imagine that happening. But, I think that does point on that there were points in which violence on the floor of Congress was not unheard of.
Well, indeed. Our friend Joanne Freeman is writing a book about this, which is coming out later in the year. There was a great deal of violence and personal antipathy in Congress, especially in the 19th century.
Yeah.
So to some extent, the decorum you were just talking about earlier is an artifact of an earlier time, but it's not necessarily as old as we think. So it's a product of the post-war period, the 1950s and 60s. And it was based, as so many of these things are, on an imagined past of the way things used to be.
Yeah.
And they may not have quite been that way. Let me ask you this, David. Do you think that, Elizabeth Warren's speech, the attempt to silence her, the birth of the hashtag and slogan, and still she persisted, is this the beginning of the 2020 presidential campaign?
I'm loath to predict the future because I'm usually wrong. Otherwise, I'd be buying, you know, lottery tickets. But I think she's... I know there's lots of Democrats who are very excited about her potential running out. I think every time she's been asked, she says, no, I'm not running. But, of course, that's what everybody says until the day before they actually announce that they're running for president. You know, the question of who is leading the Democratic Party right now, I think, is very much up in the air. I don't think there is a clear Democratic leadership at the moment. I'm not sure the Democrats actually need a leader at the moment because the Republicans seem to be infighting amongst themselves enough where, it may be best for Democrats to sort of sit back and watch and see what happens and figure out who's the best candidate to lead them going forward. Obviously, the amount of political power that a minority party has in Congress, you know, when the White House and both houses of Congress are controlled by the same party, there's only so much you can do, especially considering that the filibuster may or may not be on the way out. You know, thinking about speech in Congress, you know, the filibuster had always been sort of the tool that the minority party had, and it doesn't seem as if... It seems that there's potential the filibuster may be on the way out. Obviously, it was killed for certain kinds of nominations and appointments or people who are talking about it with the Supreme Court seat. But I'm not sure Republicans who get to obviously change the rules of the Senate whenever they want to are going to sort of let it stand.
Yes, we'll see. And in fact, one of the topics we discussed exploring today was the relationship between President Trump and the judiciary. We set that aside for two reasons. One is we have a different segment, which you're about to hear. The second is we think that's probably going to be an ongoing struggle and we'll be able to return to it in the future. Although it was very interesting to see that you know, the appeals court upheld the stay on the so-called Muslim ban, the ban on Trump's executive order on migration. So we are aware of that, but we're going to probably return to that in the future. And that relates closely to this question about the Supreme Court and the filibuster. So I'm sure we're going to return to this in future weeks. The reason we're not going to do that is because, well, we're going to have our last drop now. And then you'll hear, we're going to play a segment for you. I did an interview with a couple of colleagues about Trump and the and American foreign policy and the course of American foreign policy under President Trump. And I interviewed our colleagues and friends, Yussi Hanimaki, Professor Yussi Hanimaki from Geneva, and our own Fabian Hilfrich from the University of Edinburgh. And I recorded that segment yesterday in a local establishment. there's some ambient noise. There's some people chatting and there's some music as well. We think that Yussi and Fabian's comments are really worth listening to, but some of you ought to be warned that there is a little bit of ambient noise, and so we've left that for the end. So we're going to take our last drops now, and then the segment will play after that.
We should mention that Yussi was here in Edinburgh as part of giving our annual Fennell Lecture, which is the most prestigious lecture offered by the School of History, Classics, and Archaeology every year. And he had gave this lecture on Thursday, and they recorded this conversation in a local establishment, as we're going to call it, on Friday. So, Frank, what's your last drop?
Yes, well, I'm going to return to the Super Bowl. Which is to say that I flew back to Edinburgh from the United States on Sunday evening. I watched the very beginning of the Super Bowl at Newark Airport. And as I was boarding my flight, the New England Patriots were losing 14-0 to the Atlanta Falcons late in the second quarter. And I was not filled with optimism. When I landed in Edinburgh, 6 or 7 hours later, I turned on my phone and I was very surprised to see the result that the Patriots had won 34-28. We are not a sports podcast, but I offer this by way of an observation. When I was in the queue, and this was it was a quiet morning.
Which Americans means line.
Yes, thank you. See, I've gone native. when I was in the line or the queue to get my passport checked for non-EU citizens, so I was in the line with everybody from the flight from Newark, and there were no other flights there. So the vast majority of people in the non-UK EU line were Americans off the Newark flight. And what was striking, and most of them were talking about the Super Bowl result, which was quite surprising because, of course, like myself, when we boarded the plane, everybody thought the Patriots would lose. I'm leaning in right now to the microphone to tell New Englanders the rest of the country really hates us and our team. It became quite clear when I was chatting with the people around me that everybody in the queue who was not from New England was disappointed, in fact, gutted about this result. And it's not news to people, I suppose, that the Patriots are among the most hated teams across all the four major sports in North America, and I'd include soccer too. but this was a kind of vivid illustration. I was in a kind of involuntary focus group on this, and it was very, very striking. Although there was a woman there from Massachusetts, like myself, from Eastern Massachusetts, who I spoke to, and she didn't know the score, and I told her, and she was thrilled, and she said, "No, sir, that's awesome. I am going to have a pissa vacation now." but she was a lone voice, and I went abroad in 1992, and when I did, the New England Patriots historically had been a joke. Mm. So the Patriots being good enough to be hated, which has been true for 15 years now, is very, very new to me and still a little incongruous. This is where I'm a little bit like Rip Van Winkle. This world has happened without me. So it was just, it was an interesting and salutary reminder that really everybody hates the Patriots except for the people of New England. for reasons which, well, David, you have your own views on this when we talked earlier.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Patriots are cheaters and bad winners. My point, I boycott the Super Bowl.
Loser!
I boycott the Super Bowl for two reasons. One is that here it's a broadcast at 2 a.m. or something ridiculous like that, and I've, you know, got better things to do on, you know, Monday morning than recover from watching the Super Bowl. That, and I'm not sure I like watching brain trauma happen live on screen is something that I want to, you know, participate in, but that's my own sort of personal take on it. Anyway,
Your last draw?
So I'm going to do a film endorsement, one of which is actually two film endorsements, one of which is historical, the other one which is not. The peril of doing a film endorsement on this podcast is that half of our audience is in, as far as we know, half of our audience is in the United States, and when they release films there, when we release films here, are often radically different. We get Star Wars and the Avengers on the same day, but smaller films tend to have radically different release dates. So I'm going to do two films, one of which came out a long time ago in the United States and just came out here, and one of which came out here and is not yet in the United States, so take it for what you will. This is either a present or a delayed endorsement. The one that came out in the United States a while ago that I just got to see is Loving, which is the story of the interracial couple that challenged, with the help of the ACLU. Everyone give money to the ACLU. They're doing good work then and now. The challenge with the aid of the ACLU, Virginia's ban on interracial marriage, and led to the Supreme Court case that struck down the bans across the country and in some ways paved the way for the Supreme Court endorsing gay marriage several years ago. So it's an important legal case. The movie actually doesn't do the legal case very much. It is very much a story of the couple and their children. And it was sort of a refreshing take on a historical episode where there isn't a huge amount of, you know, complexity to the story. The story in some ways is very, very simple, but it was remarkably well told. You know, the dialogue isn't complicated. The characters aren't hugely nuanced. They just love each other a great deal and, you know, are trying to live in a world that doesn't accept their marriage. And so that was worth seeing. If you haven't seen it, I think it came out in the States a long time ago, just came out here in the UK, so UK viewers, take a look. The other thing I saw, which came out here in the UK, I guess about a week ago, is not out yet in the US, but will be soon, so you guys should all keep a lookout for it, is Trainspotting 2. And Frank is giggling because, of course, Trainspotting, the first one that came out 20 years ago, takes place here in Edinburgh. The original, of course, is the story of a gang of heroin users, and the sequel is basically a follow-up of them 20 years later. The original takes place in Edinburgh, was only filmed a small fragment of it here. The second one, though, they filmed all of it here, and there's lots of good sort of local scenes, and it was really nice to see it here and see the, you know, characters interact with the local environment. I actually saw some of the filming, at least the crews for the filming last summer when they were filming it. So that's definitely worth a watch. It's a good study of middle-aged masculinity and coming to grips with things that happened, you know, when one was young and energetic and trying to sort of deal with those consequences.
Excellent. Well, yes, and this has been the Middle-Aged Masculinity Podcast.
All right, everybody. We encourage you to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We're at Whiskey Rebel Pod. You can also look at us on our show page, whiskeyrebellion.podbeam.com. Any other things we should mention on the...
No, stay tuned and listen to our interview with UC and Fabian.
It should be a good time. I actually haven't listened to all of it yet, so y'all can listen to it with me.
And we'll see you next week. Right. Hello there, everyone. We're doing something a little bit different here. We're actually on location in Edinburgh in a local establishment. And I'm here with two good friends, Professor Yussi Hanimaki. Yussi is the Professor of International History at the Graduate Institute of Geneva,
And Fabian Hilfrich is a lecturer, a senior lecturer in American history here at the University of Edinburgh, who specializes in the history of American foreign relations. And I'm here with UC and Fabian because, of course, Trump, President Trump and Trumpism doesn't only affect the United States. David and I often think, look at the impact of contemporary events from an expat perspective, but of course what happens in the United States affects the entire world. And UC and Fabian are experts on how the U.S. interacts with the world, so we want to take this opportunity to get their thoughts on how they think the Trump presidency will affect transatlantic relations. So, UC, any views?
Oh, lots of views. The easy answer is we just don't know quite yet how everything is. So the easy answer is we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen in the next 4 years. In part because even the past year with the presidential campaign, of course, was full of unpredictable events and statements and so on. We've seen the first few weeks of the Trump administration being a lot of ups and downs in terms of executive orders being issued, then being challenged in the courts and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of uncertainty, but I think that is, at the moment at least, that's the biggest effect of the election of Donald Trump on the rest of the world, is that everything seems very uncertain. We don't really know how the Trump administration will relate to Russia. We don't know how they're going to relate necessarily to the European Union and various issues in terms of trade. We don't know for sure what the Trump administration's policy is going to be vis-a-vis NATO. So in terms of transatlantic relations, there's a lot of uncertainties. What we can say, though, is that none of the, so far, and it's only been a few weeks, so we don't know.
Feels like it's been longer.
It feels like it's been 100 years or something, right? But nothing actually dramatic in terms of transatlantic relations has really transpired. Nothing totally unexpected has transpired so far. And there's been, in certain instances, even been some pullback of the more alarming statements that were made previously. For example, about NATO, there's been some reassuring sounds that, well, yeah, actually NATO, okay, there's a problem with the funding structure, with Europeans not paying enough. Other than that, the US, Trump said himself this week, is going to, you know, support NATO, and NATO is important and so on. So this, there's that. So I think in terms of, and maybe that just reflects the fact that maybe transatlantic relations are clearly not a priority at the moment for the Trump administration. Their priorities are somewhere else. It's about, maybe it's in just simply projecting some kind of an image of somebody who's in charge and so on, and can get things done and can, you know, build walls and whatever. But it's not really a, in terms of some kind of rupture or damage that cannot be repaired. That sign, we don't, I haven't seen signs of that just yet, at least.
Fabian, would you agree with that?
Well, I think, I mean, even just for the sake of having an argument, I think I'd have to disagree, because I think at least, I agree with you that in terms of concrete steps having been taken, yes, we have not seen anything yet. But if we look at the mood music in the last few weeks since Trump has been inaugurated, there certainly has been a lot of antagonism coming out of the White House, coming from Trump personally, whether it's towards the EU. I agree with you, he has sort of retracted the worst statements about NATO. But he has certainly argued against the EU. He has argued against the steps the EU and the IMF are taking together. in terms of Greece, and of course the next tranche of Greece's debt is coming up, is going to be negotiated soon. So it will be very interesting to see. I mean, when those first concrete steps are being taken, and we will have to see what Trump, for example, does with the American votes on the IMF Council. Will he, as he would have the power to, will he stop the next tranche from being handed over to Greece? Will he be interested in provoking a Greek debt crisis and basically Greek exit from the EU, or at least from the euro? Ironic developments, I would say, as well, when you look particularly at this country, when you look at the UK. Obviously going for Brexit now, which forces the UK to go more closely together to re-celebrate and rededicate the special relationship. We have seen we've seen Theresa May go to Washington and symbolically hand in hand with Donald Trump, which I have to say, from a personal point of view, I find quite ironic to antagonize Brussels and to say how terrible Brussels is, and only to hook up very closely and very intimately with the Trump administration.
What do you think? The past 4 weeks have been incredibly hectic and frantic. It's almost been impossible to keep up with the pace of events. Even somebody who closely follows the news, it's been one thing after another. But what we haven't yet seen is a real crisis. And every single president will confront a crisis at some time, sometimes multiple crises at the same time. We saw a little bit, I suppose, in terms of the raid on the Yemeni raid that went badly, although that doesn't seem to have gained much traction with the public or the press. How do you think the Trump administration will respond to its first international crisis, whatever it may be?
It depends a lot what that crisis is. I mean, if it's in the Middle East, it's going to be, you know, some kind of related to terrorism in the Middle East. Terrorism is going to be a very aggressive response, I think. In some ways, it's going to be very publicly sort of meant to. I think you have to remember that a lot of this, the reason why Trump does, it seems to me, the reason he does things is because he needs to be in the spotlight. He needs to be sort of setting the tone of the discourse, public discourse, and all the rest of it. So that's why there have been terrorist strikes, of course, in the Trump administration already. But one of them was in Quebec,
yeah,
and somehow they failed to notice it.
Freddie chose not to recognize that as a crisis.
Yeah. So that obviously was a big crisis for those living in Quebec, in Canada, and
of course,
so on, and it was noticed as well. And that somehow fell below the Trump administration's radar. So it depends a little. I think a lot of, so if it's a crisis, and I think this what's troubling about the court decision, the sort of, put, I don't know what the exact legal term is. It's the refugee ban thing.
Yeah, they put a stay on it.
Yeah,
put
a stay on
and
it, thank
the,
you. Yeah.
The appeals court upheld the stay.
Right, and they upheld it 3-0, so it's unanimous ruling and all of this. See, and Trump is apparently fuming about all of this. Fine, but assume something happens. I mean, this is also, it's a sort of a setup in some ways, you know. If there were to be some kind of a terrorist incident that could be traced to some kind of Middle Eastern origin on American soil.
Particularly from one of those seven
from
countries.
From one of those countries,
one
yes.
One of those
yes.
seven countries. That will give the administration a huge boost in arguing that, we were right in the, right away, that we should have banned all of this and, you know, give us more power to... Yeah, so I think it's going to be, no matter what, and who knows if such a crisis will take place, but I think, like most administrations before that, the crisis can be instrumentalized in some ways to be used to promote preconceived policies. that are already there. So I think that the way the Trump administration and its members and maybe the president, they regard the world and where they see threats coming from, will cloud the way in which they react to different types of crises. Because there's going to be plenty of crises, there's no question about that. But if it's a white supremacist in Quebec City, or if it's a Muslim in any NATO country, I guess, at this point, you know, you're going to see very different types of responses, regardless, and it doesn't matter, you know, the white supremacists may kill 50 people, and there may be no casualties, or maybe very few casualties in the other type, but the nature of the crisis is going to sort of determine the response.
I mean, what I'm worried about, frankly, is the way the government has reacted so far to crises and to challenges, which seems to be very instinctive and not reasoned. I mean, one would hope that, for example, the stay of the ban. And I think the ban was very badly planned, very badly conceived. It wasn't shared across the relevant government departments beforehand. So I think that is also, that's an example of very bad decision making. One would hope that maybe something like the stay now moderates this kind of behavior, so that maybe next time the Trump administration will think, well maybe we rather think before we act. But of course, particularly in response to a crisis, the fear is very much that this kind of automatic shooting from the hip will prevail again, and that there is no reasoned response to a crisis. And that is very much my fear, that so far the mode of decision making in this government has frightened me very often, more than the decisions that have been made.
Right, and crises by their very nature are filled with uncertainty and things as Donald Trump once said, known unknowns and unknown unknowns, etc.
Yes, yes.
You know, and crisis situations are fluid and changing, and they require some subtlety and wisdom.
Yeah.
Yes.
If they're to be managed.
I think they also require sort of
reflection.
Very quick, reflection, but also sort of, so what are the facts? And of course, this is not a strong point at the moment in discourse in the United States. You know, there are alternate facts everywhere and so on and so forth. So that's, one would expect that, you know, a crisis happens, the first thing of the crisis manager, and ultimately it's going to be the president in the United States, if it's a national security crisis, that what the first thing they want to do is know the facts. And I, you know, given the history of all the what's been going on over the last year, I wonder if this president will want to know all the facts before he makes any decision, or he's interested in the facts. And that's something I would like to think, yes, but, and I'd like to think there are people around him that will tell him, okay, well, let's, you know, you don't have to go for the nuclear option right away. That, you know, let's think about this. You know.
In this context, nuclear option takes on another sinister.
I know.
You're not speaking metaphorically.
yeah, let's hope so.
It's, I find that very interesting, you see, because, again, if one thinks about recent terrorist attacks in the past few years, almost always the initial reports are inaccurate.
Yeah, yes.
Because that's the nature of such a situation. Yeah.
Nobody knows what's going on, but something bad happened.
You know, and there have been, unfortunately, all too many of such incidents around the world. But almost always the initial news reports, like the attack in the Christmas market in Berlin before Christmas, and the guy who was arrested, who was,
who was not the guy.
No, it was not the guy. And the German police very quickly, proved his innocence and released him, but the initial news reports were such. That's exactly the kind of scenario that could unfold. In which case, one needs to respond to a crisis, but one also has to deliberate before responding.
Absolutely,
to a crisis.
And this, I mean, crisis management is one of the biggest challenges, I think, especially when the stakes can be very, very high. You know, you can think of the Cuban missile crisis, things like that. You can, and the false reporting. I remember I was in the United States in 1994, before, I think, when they had in Oklahoma City,
right,
the bombings, the initial reactions, oh, which Middle Eastern, they were stopping people at the airports, so until it turned out, I don't know, 24 hours later, actually, it was this white supremacist, Terry, whatever his name was.
Timothy McVeigh.
There you go. But this, you know, the outpouring, the initial 24 hours of this anti-Arab, I guess, so anti-Muslim sort of, you know, they did this, was amazing. And it's obviously...
And that was a much calmer time than this is, because that was pre-9/11.
Exactly. Now we have we have 9/11 in the background, and we have all this sort of premeditated... You know, everybody has the gun ready to go out and shoot if they need something like this. And that wasn't literally meant that way, but... Yeah. You know.
I mean, I think, you know, in some respects, I mean, I know this is moving away a little bit, but what...
We go where the conversation leads us, Fabio.
But what I find interesting, you know, from the point of view of a professional historian, is this is almost like a laboratory experiment. If we talk about transatlantic relations, if we talk about global relations, on whether structures will be stronger than personalities. You know, I mean, because a lot of my fears right now come from the personalities involved and whether they will dominate responses, whether to crises or whether to longer standing questions of international import, or whether it is established structures, NATO, you know, transatlantic relations generally speaking, both on the bilateral but also on the multilateral level, all the organizations in which our countries cooperate and collaborate, whether that is going to carry the day or whether the sort of, you know, the gut reactions by the president and his entourage will carry the day in these important decisions.
Right, because there's as you well know, a huge administrative and bureaucratic structure that administers U.S. foreign policy.
Yes, absolutely.
And these bureaucratic structures have their own logic and they move at their own pace often. And sometimes that can prevent rapid actions or rapid responses. So maybe, and it will be interesting, and maybe it's that bureaucratic inertia might provide the, might force the kind of deliberation you were talking about using.
Sure. And I think, I mean, if I may just add that, I think that, you know, there is a lot of recognition and there has been a lot of applause for the actions of American courts in response to the ban, which clearly did not play well anywhere in Europe, but so there was great relief not only in some parts of the United States, but also in Europe as well, that American institutions seem to be working and seem to be correcting some of these really rash steps that had been taken.
That's true. But, I mean, there's another thing that's true about the ban, which is there was also in some circles very popular or seen as a kind of a model in Europe. So you've heard these, like Marie Le Pen and others say that, you know, yeah, we have to also protect our country against, you know, and of course, if you're thinking France, you're thinking Nice, you're thinking Paris, you think actually we have real cause of concern, unlike the Americans maybe who haven't had a, you know, this sort of experiences in the recent past. So I wonder how that is going to play out. I mean, in the next months, politically.
I think that's a really good point, Yusuf, because if we've learned one thing, and on one hand, this is obvious; it should be obvious to us, but we sometimes forget it. We talk about the United States and Europe or whatever. These aren't monolithic entities. There's a huge amount of opposition to Trump and his policies within the United States, and that is shared, of course, around the world in many places. But there are people who sympathize with what he's doing in the United States,
and
but also, crucially, we forget, abroad.
Yeah.
Not majorities in any way, but so it's often a more complicated situation than it appears. Yeah. It's not just Trump is a kind of proxy for America, and America stands for this, and Europe is opposed. It's a much more complicated situation, and one also wonders when a crisis comes, the degree to which domestic political concerns will motivate President Trump, as they, all presidents factor those into crisis, or, when they're deliberating. To some extent, that's the most important aspect of a response. And so it's a very complicated political mosaic, really, I think.
No, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, if we are talking about transatlantic relations, that, of course, has become part of it. I mean, there are these transatlantic relations where Trump has taken encouragement from Brexit, and where, in turn, other right-wing populist forces in other European countries have taken encouragement from Trump. And just recently, you know, the Hungarian Prime Minister Orbán said that his latest measures against basically putting asylum seekers into camps was motivated by, you know, that he was sure this would be a step that Trump would welcome.
Yeah.
So Trump has already become, you know, a beacon of hope for right-wing populists in Europe.
Yeah. One final question, guys. I was at an event in Washington last weekend, and I met a guy who worked for a government agency in the United States who was expressing real concern about the impact of the ban on America's image abroad. And as he put it, this was before the courts came down with their ruling, but he said it will take years for us to recover and to repair the damage that's been done to America's image in the past week, in the aftermath of the ban. As people who know the United States well, study the United States, but do so outside of the United States, and in terms of your own personal backgrounds, if I can reveal this, are not American. Could I ask you to respond to, I guess, to that statement, not to that statement in particular, but the more general question of how lasting will be the long-term impact of the Trump presidency on the way people view America?
I think it's, as long as there's a Trump presidency, there's going to be a lot of, I think, the majority opinion in Europe, and in not all around the world, but in many parts of the world, probably going to be negative about the United States. And it's going to, so what's happened in 2016 in the election is basically the exact reverse that happened in 2008. So in 2008 we had this, you know, unpopular, at least abroad, very unpopular Bush presidency, and Obama was elected, and there was the Obama bounces, the sort of people who look at transatlantic public opinions and so on. There's a huge bounce in terms of now America has seen the light again. You know, they elected the right guy and at the right time, and now there's hope in the world. And there were even German newspapers, I think it was the Spiegel or somebody, said that, oh, Obama is the world's president now.
Yes, yes, so, exactly, yes.
So there was this...
Where the Spiegel had had an image on its cover last week of Trump having beheaded the Statue of Liberty.
So there's clearly... and this kind of personality matters and so on. But I think... So there's going to be... I mean, the simple fact that Trump was elected and is now the president of the United States. Many people in Europe, I think, undoubtedly, as long as he's the president, they're going to look at the United States in a different light, predominantly negative light, because they sort of see this as proof of some irrational tendency, perhaps, in the American body politic. And however, that can change overnight when Trump is no longer president and there's somebody else that, you know, the world of the, you know, Europeans feel, see is sort of the antidote to Trump, you know, so in a way that Obama was the antidote to Bush in 2008. And, you know, that's, so that there's certain fickle element in the public opinion about the United States. And I, and so this is not, you know, yes, it will have an impact. It's going to create a negative sense about the United States.
Oddly enough, I think now I'm gonna play the optimist, and I think that, you know, that I mean, there is also the sort of transatlantic relation or transatlantic spirit that we've seen expressed in a lot of these, you know, in a lot of these demonstrations that sure. we've seen recently, which, you know, yeah. which have been, I mean, global to a certain yeah. extent. And so yeah. so I think there is also in Europe that there is this time more than there was with the Bush administration, a feeling that Trump is not necessarily America. Whereas I think, you know, with George Bush and particularly with the Iraq War, the impression in Europe was, well, this is America. This is American policy. Whereas this time
yeah.
around,
that's a good point. Yeah.
I think, and you know, particularly then also seeing the courts react to the travel ban and
also
seeing
the size and scale of the demonstration.
Size and scale of the demonstration.
24 hours after the inauguration.
Size and scale of the difference in the popular vote matters. You know, that it was Hillary Clinton by 3 million votes.
Sure.
So I do think, I mean, that's the hopeful.
Well, it's just 3 million dead people.
3 million imposters.
Yeah.
But, I mean, well, it's an interesting contrast of views. I mean, I do, one thing I've tried to, that I've been thinking about is the Iraq War. And just, I mean, I was here then, and just how unpopular that was in Europe, and in Scotland in particular. Yet, as you said, you see, and at that time, 2003-04, around that time, especially when British soldiers started getting killed, you thought, wow, this is a low in transatlantic relations, and it'll take years to recover
decades.
From.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, with the election of President Obama, the recovery was very, very quick. And I'm hoping that whatever
Although
damage...
Although the war did not end, right?
No, of course the war did not end.
It was just fought differently.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's right. But the change was fairly...
Dramatic.
Dramatic. So maybe... It's very difficult in the midst of something.
Yeah.
So it seems right now, as that guy said to me last week, this will take years to recover from.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
As we began our conversation, who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
I think Europeans...
That changes everything.
I think Europeans are schizophrenic about the United States and have always been schizophrenic, that on the one hand, they are yearning for the ability to like the United States and its policies, but on the other hand, there is always, you know, the sort of mistrust of what Europeans consider as crass American attitudes and policy decisions. So, but I think, you know, what expressed itself when Obama replaced Bush was really that yearning that, you know, finally we can love the United States again.
I mean, if I make one final point, it's that overall, all of this sort of thinking about, do we like the United States and so on, there's nothing new about this in the end.
It goes back to the American Revolution, for God's sake.
But I was thinking some more recent times. But yes, as you well know, but there is, and I think what it really tells us is something about there being some kind of a transatlantic political space, which is in a sense united, in which everybody sort of feels good or bad about, say, Trump. So the negative feelings are strong in the United States and in Europe at the same time about this. In the same way as, let's say, the anti-Vietnam War movement in the 1960s was very strong in the United States and equally strong in Europe. As the anti-Iraq War trend was also stronger perhaps in Europe but in the early going, but then grew in volume. So there's something that tells to me that there's something about, you know, the fact that there is a not just NATO and so on, but there is some kind of transatlantic political space within which ideas, and also what we said earlier about sort of the extreme nationalists in Europe, whatever we call them, the nationalist movements in Europe that seem to be on the rise, in part because of Trump, or in part because of Brexit perhaps, but a combination of those two, that these are shared sort of sets of ideas that seem to peak at the same time on both sides of the Atlantic. So that maybe tells us something, that there is some kind of, these are not two separate worlds. As it was Robert Kagan who said that, you know, Americans are from Mars and Europeans are from Venus. No, they're both from, I don't know,
Earth.
The Earth. From this transatlantic space in which, you know, they're debating many of the same issues, whether it's migration, refugees, terrorism, trade, free trade, fair trade, you know, all these issues. They seem to be very common to debates within specific domestic political contexts, both sides of the Atlantic, and similar in that sense that they're sort of transnational political debates that you don't necessarily see in Russia, you don't see it in China, you don't see it in many other parts of the world, but the same. So, long story short, the West actually still exists. Something called the West. It still exists in which you do.
Well, you've heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen, here on the Whiskey Rebellion podcast. We're all on Earth.
In the West, more or less.
more or less. I want to, we're just three guys in the pub. I want to thank UC and Fabian for their comments and their insights and their time. I want to thank the DJ here for providing us with background music.
Very inspiring.
And thank you very much, fellas.
Thank you, friend.
Thank you.